It's Monday, December 2nd. I'm Jane Costin, and this is Water Day, the show that is coming back strong from the holiday weekend and definitely didn't eat too much stuffing and pie. That definitely didn't happen. Write that down. On today's show, President Biden pardons his son Hunter ahead of sentencing later this month. And good news in the pursuit to end the AIDS epidemic. Let's get into it. It's December, and we're less than 50 days away from President-elect Donald Trump taking office. Over the weekend, Trump forged ahead with more appointment announcements. He nominated Charles Kushner, the father of Trump's son-in-law, Jared, to be ambassador to France. Trump pardoned him in 2020. And he named a new head of the FBI, Kash Patel. He worked for Trump on the National Security Council before becoming chief of staff to the acting defense secretary at the end of Trump's first term, and he is very, 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 very weird. But among Democrats, the party is still litigating why Vice President Kamala Harris lost the election last month. On Sunday, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy told Meet the Press he thinks Democrats need to push a more populist message going forward to win back working-class voters.
I think some of the most important things that Joe Biden did were taking on the big corporations, going after their monopoly power, helping consumers with some of the really egregious fees and gimmicks that those companies use to hurt us. I wish the Biden campaign and the Biden White House and the Harris campaign talked more about what they did to break up corporate power.
What it kind of sounds like Murphy is saying there is that President Joe Biden and Vice President Harris did pursue populist policies, they just didn't talk about them enough. On MSNBC Saturday, former Ohio Democratic Representative Tim Ryan said something similar. He rattled off a bunch of Biden's legislative wins.
Democrats are reindustrializing the country. Like, this is the first industrial policy this country has had in 40 or 50 years with the IRA, the batteries, the, you know, all the clean energy stuff, the infrastructure bill, and of course, the CHIPS Act, which is hitting Ohio. We're going to have a $100 billion investment.
Ryan says Biden delivered a direct win for his state. So why didn't Ohio vote for Joe Biden? Here's Ryan again.
Our brand is toxic in so many places. And it's like, you're a Democrat? Like, that's the stuff we get, like, in Ohio.
It's hard to wrap your head around. If the whole idea behind small-d Democratic politics is that a person runs for office, promises to do things voters say they want, and then actually delivers, then voters should reward them by reelecting them. It's a concept known as deliverism, the idea that if you deliver for voters, they'll deliver votes for you. Except it didn't really seem to work for Democrats in 2024. So to talk through the concept of deliverism a little more, I spoke with Matt Iglesias. He's a journalist and he writes a Substack newsletter, Slow Boring, about a practical approach to politics and policy. Matt Iglesias, welcome to Water Day.
Hi, good to be here.
So can you explain the concept of deliverism? What is it and how is it supposed to work?
Okay, shortly after the transition, after I think Democrats had won the Georgia special elections, I was talking to, you know, somebody in congressional leadership, and he told me, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to show that we can deliver meaningful change for the American people. That's going to mean shots in arms, checks in pockets, student loan relief. He, you know, rattled off a list of sort of policy objectives for Democrats. And he was pitching me on the idea that, like, if we get all this stuff done, people are going to love it. And, you know, the boil of Trumpism will be lanced. I think the actual word deliverism, David Dayen sort of made up in an American Prospect article, but making a similar point that it's not good enough to just sort of espouse popular ideas on the campaign trail. You need to deliver them in office. And if you could tell people, like, here's this long list of amazing things we did for you, then they're going to love it.
Well, it seems like Biden and, by extension, Vice President Harris really banked on this concept because the administration did a lot in 4 years. There was the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the single largest investment in climate and energy infrastructure, like, ever. There was a CHIPS Act to boost production of semiconductors, a push for student loan forgiveness, a bipartisan infrastructure deal, the largest one-year drop in child poverty. So why didn't it work? Like, if you thought deliverism is we deliver you stuff you say you want, you deliver us votes, why? What? Where's the disconnect? What happened?
I think the biggest tell here is not just they did a lot of stuff, which, you know, they did, but that they they leaned into that characterization of themselves as having done a lot, right? If somebody would say, you know, Joe Biden has the longest record of progressive achievement of any president since Lyndon Johnson, the White House would like mash retweet on that, right? They wouldn't say like, no, that's not true. Joe Biden is running an incredibly bipartisan, administration, right? They wanted an image as having achieved a lot, and they were granted that often in the press. I think it's really a kind of fundamental misread of how public opinion works. There's this old result, Christopher Wlitzen, I believe, came up with the title, Public Opinion as a Thermostat. And it's like when people perceive that a lot of progressive policy change is happening, what happens is they develop more conservative issue preferences. And when, you know, when Trump was in office, you had the opposite, right? So
right.
Trump talked constantly about how terrible immigrants were and all the mean things he was going to do to immigration. And public opinion swung way to the left as a result of that. Then Biden came in and was like, we need to be more welcoming to people seeking asylum. And the result of that is that public opinion swung way to the right. And, you know, I think that's just a kind of fundamental truth about American politics. It's why the president's party usually does poorly in the midterms. It's why, you know, we tend to see the party swinging back and forth across these close elections, because people are very upset about the system, right? And like the establishment, but people are nervous about large-scale policy change.
So are we just a nation of malcontents? Because it just sounds like, okay, the president is going to zig and America zags. What do we do with that?
So I do think this question of sort of anti-establishment sentiment and what it means is really kind of fundamental, because people have a very low level of confidence in political elites. And so when they hear a partisan agenda being enacted and it's controversial, they tend to be suspicious of that. And, you know, I mean, a really infamous thing from 2009 or 2010, right, was Nancy Pelosi was on the floor of the House and she's giving a speech and she says, we have to pass the bill, the Affordable Care Act, so that people can find out what's in it. And this was like a huge gaffe at the time, and it only exacerbated people's concerns about that legislation. Then what happened was they passed the bill. Implementation took several years, but by the time Donald Trump was president, it had been implemented. Then when he started saying he wanted to repeal it, people found out what was in the bill, right? I mean, exactly as the former speaker had said. And they were like, what? You want to take away protections for people with pre-existing conditions? You want to let women be discriminated against in insurance premiums? You want to kick millions of people off Medicaid? And they hated that idea. So it is a little bit of like a nation of haters dynamic. And, you know, I mean, I think that's just something like you have to learn to live with.
Do you think that this election was a repudiation of the concept of deliverism, or were Biden and Harris just working against big headwinds, fallout from the pandemic, high inflation, and a global rejection of incumbents?
It's a little bit of both, right? I mean, you know, clearly the thing people wanted delivered was like cheaper grocery prices, and they didn't deliver that. I don't know how much they could have done that would have delivered what they wanted. But, you know, you talked about, you know, after the pandemic, incumbents everywhere have been really struggling. The 2020 election happened in an odd time, right? They were catching some of that pandemic discontent, but it was early enough that it came back around and hit them, right? If the election had been 18 months in the future, Democrats could have just been the ones who rode to the rescue. If it had happened earlier, they might have just gotten wiped out. But it happened at this bend point, right, where it was tempting to see people's concern about pandemic relief and so on and so forth as like demand for this enormous progressive agenda. But then when the progressive agenda was rolled out, you know, everyone just wanted like chicken to be cheaper, which is, I sympathize with. I also want chicken to be cheaper.
I think something, you made this point that Trump's lowest period of polling during his presidency wasn't when he did any of the nonsensical bullshit he did. It's mm-hmm. the closest he came to eliminating the Affordable Care Act. That was when people were like, oh, absolutely, we are furious about this. So Trump has promised a lot of things. Trump has been, as I've said, kind of the sixth grade presidential candidate president where he promised everybody everything all the time. Does he have to deliver on those promises? And does it matter? Does he have to deliver? Is there deliverism for Trump?
I mean, I think he doesn't have to deliver. I mean, I think the more Trump delivers, the worse off he's going to be, right? Like, if he were to actually deliver on this Make America Healthy Again concept, right? Like,
banning gummy worms. Nope.
I mean, if he were to, you know, make people stop eating candy, a lot of candy enjoyers would get mad. If he was to get Americans to consume less soy and corn oil, which is like a big like right-wing talking point, but like Iowa, which used to be a swing state, has become a hard right state, right? If the government tried to like ban their major agricultural outputs, people there would be quite upset. Whereas if they can just sort of like post about it, you know, that just like, like the libs, they don't want you to know about manly public health, you know, like, let's pump some iron. That's, you know, kind of like vague position taking works well for them. I think you really see this on, like, on the immigration issue, right? Where like, if you were to actually deport millions and millions of people from the country, that would cause a lot of problems in people's daily life, right? Like when your favorite restaurant closes down because the dishwashers all got deported. And then it turns out that like half those dishwashers had kids in the local school. And there's all these sad stories. It's like, or if, you know, groceries, again, if they get more expensive because you got rid of all the farm workers, people aren't going to like that. But people right now say they like the idea of mass deportation. So I think like to the extent that Trump is all talk, no action, that's probably good for him.
Matt, as always, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
That was my conversation with Matt Iglesias. He's a journalist and writes a Substack newsletter, Slow Boring. We'll get to more of the news in a moment, but if you like the show, make sure to subscribe, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, watch us on YouTube, and share with your friends. More to come after some ads.
Hey, it's John. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics about how to fix this mess. We're doing it again, November 5th through the 7th in Washington, D.C. with even more podcast panels and workshops. Plus, there will be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get your tickets at CrookedCon.com, where we'll also announce the lineup. If you're a Friends of the Pod subscriber, a limited number of discounted tickets are still available. Get them before they run out. See you at CrookedCon.
And now the news.
Headlines.
I just want to alert you all to some breaking news that we're getting. NBC News is reporting that President Biden is expected to pardon his son, Hunter Biden.
That was Strict Scrutiny host Melissa Murray on MSNBC, breaking the news that President Biden pardoned his son Hunter on Sunday night. According to White House officials, Biden made the decision over the weekend. And in a statement on Sunday, the president said he did it because his son was, quote, selectively and unfairly prosecuted. He wrote, quote, I believe in the justice system, but as I have wrestled with this, I also believe raw politics has infected this process and it led to a miscarriage of justice. He also took aim at Republicans for targeting Hunter in the media, writing, quote, in trying to break Hunter, they've tried to break me, and there's no reason to believe it will stop here. Enough is enough. This is a huge reversal for Biden, who has said repeatedly that he would not use his executive power to pardon his son. Here's White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responding to a question on the subject during a press briefing earlier this year.
From a presidential perspective, is there any possibility that the president would end up pardoning his son?
No.
I just answered.
Hunter was days away from sentencing for federal gun charges and federal tax evasion. He faced a maximum of 42 years in prison. A new rebel coalition has shocked Syrian officials in the country's ongoing civil war. The rebel group began its surprise offensive against President Bashar al-Assad's government last week and continued on Sunday. The group seized a large swath of Aleppo, the country's largest city, on Saturday. The civil war between Assad and rebel forces began in 2011. Assad has held on to Aleppo since 2016 with the help of ally countries like Russia and Iran. Syria's military has temporarily withdrawn from Aleppo to regroup. Here's what U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan had to say about the rebel offensive on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
What we would like to see is the full implementation of UN Security Council resolutions that could bring a measure of peace and stability to Syria and protection to civilians, including religious minorities.
The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that rebel fighters made more advances on Sunday toward the southern city of Hama. More than 300 people have been killed in the fighting so far. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA, has suspended deliveries through Israel's main route after officials said on Sunday that it's become too dangerous on Gaza's side of the border. Armed gangs looted nearly 100 delivery trucks last month, stealing all the food and supplies inside. UNICEF has also called the conditions unacceptable. Israel has blamed Hamas for the lootings, but UNRWA has pointed the finger at Israel, accusing its military of failing to keep the route safe. World Central Kitchen, another major aid group working in Gaza, also shut down on Saturday, citing safety concerns. An Israeli airstrike killed three of its workers over the weekend. This is the second time an Israeli airstrike has killed World Central Kitchen volunteers. Israel claimed that one of the people killed in the strike over the weekend had ties to Hamas. WCK says that they have no knowledge of any of their staff being affiliated with the group. The Wall Street Journal reported that Egyptian and Israeli officials are in talks to reopen a border crossing near the southern city of Rafah. If they make a deal, it could reopen before the end of the year. President Joe Biden spoke on the White House South Lawn on Sunday as part of World AIDS Day, talking to survivors and their families.
I hope you can find comfort in remembering one thing is never lost: your love for them and their love for you. Jill and I, along with countless others, are forever grateful to you for your collective and individual courage.
There are 39 million people living with HIV worldwide. The fight against AIDS has come a long way, and the disease is no longer the death sentence it used to be. A new drug from pharmaceutical company Gilead has some researchers excited that it could be a possible vaccine. Studies have shown Sunlenca, a twice-yearly injection, has been 100% effective in preventing HIV infections in women and almost as effective in men. Gilead is seeking authorization to have the drug used as an HIV preventative with the hope of ending the AIDS epidemic. About 630,000 people died of AIDS last year, the lowest number since 2004. Experts from the United Nations say we're at a, quote, historic crossroads where ending the disease might be possible. And holy shit, after more than 40 years of death and stigma and loss, what an achievement that would be. And that's the news. One more thing. So, while we were on Thanksgiving break, Donald Trump was doing what he does best. Posting. A lot. He loves to post. Always has. He's just a born poster. Anyway, last Wednesday, Trump posted, quote, "I will be working on a large-scale United States advertising campaign explaining how bad fentanyl is for people to use, millions of lives being so needlessly destroyed. By the time the campaign is over, everyone will know how really bad the horror of this drug is." Now, if there's anything I know about hard drugs, it's that the people who do them, particularly drugs like fentanyl, probably know it's not good for them. And as a DARE graduate, I'm also aware that let's do a big ad campaign so that everyone knows drugs are bad has a winning percentage worse than Ohio State's against Michigan since 2021. That's 0-4 for those who aren't keeping track. But I actually want to make a larger point, which is that there's a good chance this large-scale United States advertising campaign either doesn't happen at all or become something so anodyne that we all kind of just forget about it. Because Donald Trump is not just a poster, he's a liar. And that should be a big factor in how we cover him and how you think about him. I was going to make a big list of Trump's failed promises from his first term, from "we're going to eliminate the U.S. debt in 8 years," to "we're going to bring back coal," to his 2016 promise to eliminate gun-free zones on day one, and his plan to enact a 5-year ban on executive branch employees becoming lobbyists. But if I did that, we'd be here for hours, because Donald Trump lies all the time. So much so that his entire political appeal seems to me to rely on him being a liar. Of course, he just won't do the scariest stuff he repeatedly promises to do, because he never does. That's not to say that his lies don't matter. He's going to be the president of the United States again. So how he lies and what he lies about is important. But posts aren't policies, and we can't treat them like they are. Posts don't tell you answers to questions like, who's going to pay for this, and will this work, and wait, seriously, people know fentanyl is bad for you. You know that, right? So the next time Donald Trump posts something on the internet, which knowing him will probably be right about now, take a second to remember that we cannot spend the next 4 years running after every Truth Social pronouncement. Our nervous systems can't handle that, or at least mine can't. So let's pay attention to what Trump does, who he hires, what bills he signs. Because honestly, we are way too busy for posts. Before we go, last week on Pod Save the World, Tommy and Ben dug into the latest on the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. They also sat down with Malala Yousafzai, the global icon for girls' education and Nobel Peace Prize winner who survived a Taliban attack in 2012. In this rare interview, Malala reflects on what happened when the Taliban retook Afghanistan in 2021. She also talks about her new documentary, Bread and Roses. Listen to this episode now on the Pod Save the World feed or watch the full interview on YouTube. That's all for today. If you like the show, make sure you subscribe, leave a review, go on and give your son-in-law's father a job, and tell your friends to listen. And if you're into reading, and not just about how it's fun to remember the time Donald Trump said he wouldn't play golf as president, like me, What A Day is also a nightly newsletter. Check it out and subscribe at crooked.com/subscribe. I'm Jane Costin, and go blue, baby! What A Day is a production of Crooked Media. It's recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Our associate producer is Raven Yamamoto. Our producer is Michelle Eloy. We had production help today from Tyler Hill, Johanna Case, Joseph Dutra, Greg Walters, and Julia Clare. Our senior producer is Erica Morrison, and our executive producer is Adrian Hill. Our theme music is by Colin Gilliard and Kashaka.
Hey, it's John. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics about how to fix this mess. We're doing it again, November 5th through the 7th in Washington, D.C. with even more podcast panels and workshops. Plus, there will be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get your tickets at CrookedCon.com, where we'll also announce the lineup. If you're a Friends of the Pod subscriber, a limited number of discounted tickets are still available. Get them before they run out. See you at CrookedCon.